Yet you can see how when we start thinking about making policy change or reforming a particular institution or system, I want the people on that committee to be really clear, grounded, loving, balanced, compassionate, generous people. I want them to have some internal transformation work done. So the two are connected, and we need to work on both levels.
Welcome to How We Change the World podcast. Today, my guest is Orin J. Sofer, a revered and beloved teacher of mindfulness, meditation, and nonviolent communication. Orin is a longtime practitioner of Buddhist meditation, which is just one tool in his large array of mindfulness practices that truly allows him to guide so many others in how to open their hearts and truly change the world. His new book, Your Heart Was Made for This, is a contemplative guide for a world in crisis. Today, he shares not just the essence of this latest book and his latest work, but also his profound belief in the need and the urgency to transform our own lives as the catalyst for societal healing. So get ready to be inspired and educated by Orin's insights on how we can meet today's global challenges with integrity, with love, and with unwavering courage. Good morning, J. Orin Sofer, and welcome to How We Change the World.
Absolutely. It's Orin J. Sofer, but you can call me, me Orin. You put my middle name first, which no one's ever done, which is kind of neat.
I'm very dyslexic. I'm not with words, but I mean with writing, but I seem to be speaking, so my great apologies.
No worries.
Anyway, I was just so happy to get this opportunity to have you on the podcast. You have the mindset and the tools and the knowledge and really the open heart, I think, that we need to be able to change the world, which is what this podcast is about. And you're doing it in your own very special way. So that's the reason why I'm so joyful, really, to have you here, even if I did mess up your name.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here and have the chance to talk.
Well, I think that these are the tools, some of the tools you're going to be talking about today and some of the tools that are in your book and all that you do with your online trainings and your retreats, that you're teaching us the skills that we are really lacking at a time that we need them at the most, at least the most in our lifetimes, I would argue. So, well, let's talk a little bit then about who you are and what you do, maybe before we talk about your book, which I can't wait to speak about, which is called Your Heart Was Made for This, and a longer subtitle, which we will add in. But to know the person behind it is very helpful in actually appreciating what's in the book, I think. Obviously you are a teacher of Buddhist meditation. That's not obvious, but you are a Buddhist meditation teacher. You teach nonviolent communication, mindfulness, some tools that are becoming more and more popular, but you've been doing this for a very long time. So how did you get started at the beginning with mindfulness and with meditation?
Yeah. Just very ordinary middle-class, global North American suffering. I grew up in New Jersey, and I was introduced to the ideas that come out of Buddhist and South Asian philosophy and religion through the Transcendentalists, Emerson and Thoreau, in high school, and it really fascinated me. And when I got to college, in New York City, I was going through a really hard time. My parents were getting divorced, and just sort of ordinary things. Had a falling out with my friends. I was a childhood actor, and I was running around the city acting, doing a lot of drugs. I just got really disconnected from myself.
Right.
And so I started taking religion classes, and it really grabbed me. And when I had the opportunity to take a semester to study abroad, I was very fortunate to apply and be accepted into a Buddhist studies program in India. So I traveled to India when I was 19 and lived in a Buddhist monastery for 3 months and learned to practice meditation. It changed my life. It changed the direction of my life. It felt like it was what I had been waiting for to hear, things that had been troubling me ever since I can remember started to make sense just about being human. And so that's how I got started with meditation. And then 5 or 6 years later, I was living at a meditation center in Barre, Massachusetts, called the Insight Meditation Society, and working as a cook. And I noticed that the values and the kind of qualities I was cultivating in my meditation practice, patience, kindness, compassion, wisdom, calm, were less accessible whenever I had some kind of disagreement with one of my coworkers, and would vanish completely when I talked to anyone from my family. And so that troubled me, that there was this gap between the meditation and my relationships. And so that's when I found out about Marshall Rosenberg's work, the founder of Nonviolent Communication.
Yeah.
Which is much more than a communication practice. It's really another form of spiritual practice or awareness practice that helps us translate our values into our lives, our relationships, and our work in the world. So that came in 5 or 6 years later, and I was also quite taken with that practice and ended up becoming certified as a nonviolent communication trainer. And yeah, things just kind of unfolded from there.
So when you were, because you studied at Columbia, I believe, and so did that become your major, this comparative religions?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, I started as an English major. And then when I went to India, I got back to Columbia, and I looked at my transcript, and I had, you know, I was 3/4 of the way complete with a religion major, because I had taken all of my electives in religion courses and only 25% through the English major. And I looked at the courses I would have to take, 19th century literature, and I just, it didn't interest me. And it was a difficult decision. Because particularly for my parents, who said, you know, what are you going to do with a religion major? And, I made the choice to follow what felt right in my heart, which in the end turned out, supporting me. It doesn't always happen that way in terms of our livelihood, but I've been quite fortunate to be able to, live in a time where these practices are in demand and, to find a way to earn a living sharing them. Yeah.
Well, I was just thinking the title of your new book is Your Heart Was Made for This. It sounds a little bit autobiographical now that I hear how it went. You know, we were all exposed to, not all, that is not even a little bit accurate, but many, many, many people have been exposed to the opportunity to meditate, to dig deeper into whatever religious tradition speaks to them, you know, whatever type of calming and expanding consciousness that we, you know, are exposed to. Very few voluntarily take it, I would say. Certainly not to the level. So that's why I would have to say your heart was made for this, because it spoke to you so, so young and so powerfully. I mean, my mother took us, one of my siblings and I, to transcendental meditation practice when we were 19 and learned how, which is pretty unusual as I look back, as I'm not a youngster. So, but it did not take in me for many, many years. So yeah, I think how we come into this world is, and our experiences really does either open us to that or maybe we have to be ready for it. Actually, let me ask you one more thing before we move into further discussion or a discussion of your book and some of your teachings. Did you not study to become a Buddhist monk, or did I misinterpret that?
Yeah, I mean, more or less. I trained at some more Buddhist monasteries in my 30s for about 3 years. And there's all these steps to becoming a monk in the particular tradition I was practicing in. And so I was what we would call the technical term is a postulant, which is mm-hmm. before you become a novice, you're the low guy on the totem pole. So
pretty fancy name for the low guy on the totem pole.
Yeah, the word in the Buddhist language is anagarika, which means a homeless one. And I lived in the monasteries. I wore white robes and followed different training guidelines, not eating in the evening, being celibate. Those are the two big ones that change from a lay Buddhist practitioner. And it was very powerful training. Ultimately, was formative for me in my own life, but was not the right fit. Mm-hmm. My character.
Sure.
Feels more engaged. I wanted to have a relationship to contribute mm-hmm. in a more direct and hands-on way. And so I ended up leaving. Yeah.
Definitely
meeting
not.
My wife, getting married, teaching, and so forth.
And now you have a son as well.
I do. That's right.
Which sometimes gives one a reason to say, oh, this is why I needed to do this. Because when you have a child, you know, I think it just changes your perspective on the world so very much. Mm-hmm. And you brought a child into the life at a time which is very precarious, but it's been precarious and it's going to continue to be precarious. And I have children and grandchildren, so it must be extremely, pressing on you at times to think about the future for your child or your children. And how we can, does it put more of an exclamation point on your efforts to make the world a more engaged, a more safe and, you know, lasting place?
Yeah, of course. I think I don't. I try not to overestimate my work in its capacity to create collective change, which is, I think, a much more mysterious and complex process. Mm-hmm. Having children at this particular day and age definitely does change my perspective on life and the mm-hmm. choices that I make, and creates a different level of urgency to the challenges that we face. For sure. Yeah.
Well, you know, I always think that, and we've seen that one person can make a huge impact. Look at Martin Luther King, for example, just to pick one of many. So whether it's you or your child or one of your students, you don't know, right? And you just do what you're called to do and hope that influence is as impactful as it can be.
Yeah. Yeah, one person can, and it's also, you know, more the case, I think, also that a group of people can, right? Yeah. And that's also what we see, is that these people who emerge in history are supported by and connected to communities, and it's really all of us together that make change, mm-hmm. right?
But the leadership is so important as well. So mm-hmm. It's all important, right? Well, let's do talk about your book. It's called, it just came out, I think, a few months ago.
Yeah.
Called Your Heart Was Made for This. Contemplate. I have to read it because it's a long subtitle. Contemplative Practices for Meeting a World in Crisis with Courage, Integrity, and Love.
That's right.
Kind of botched reading that. That's a mouthful, and it's a handful, and it's probably the perfect solution. The question is, how do we enhance those qualities in ourselves and encourage it in one another, right?
Because
if courage, integrity, and love aren't the answer, then I don't know what the answer might be.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the book rests upon the understanding that individual and collective transformation are inextricably linked, and that when we focus on one alone, we kind of miss the boat. So if we focus solely on healing ourselves and transforming our own hearts and minds, we can fail to respond to the suffering in the world if we don't find a way to translate our love and our wisdom and our care into action and help with compassion and generosity and some way of giving back and contributing. And at the same time, if we focus exclusively on social transformation in any domain, mm-hmm. without also taking a good look at ourselves and being in the process of understanding and transforming our own hearts and minds, we can't actually work effectively for change because we have been infected. Our own minds have been infected with the very assumptions and forces and delusions that have created the problem itself. So, you know, it's that famous quote that gets attributed to Einstein, you can't, the consciousness that created a problem can't fix it.
Right.
And
right.
So we look throughout history and see that, you know, revolutions for social change that have succeeded, how many of them have unintentionally replaced one system of oppression and control and domination with another. So we need to marry these two avenues of transformation, the inner and the outer, and find ways to work in both, if not simultaneously, by going back and forth. And that's the place that it looks different for each of us. It can be different phases of our lives. It can be, you know, taking time out, whether it's of the day or of the year, to do some kind of deeper reflection and retreat, or being a part of a community that's committed to that. But mm-hmm. the book is really coming out of that understanding, which is in Buddhist practice is known as socially engaged Buddhism, which says that we have to apply the principles of transforming suffering that are at the heart of Buddhism to the social and collective level. And it's mm-hmm. looking at this one particular question of how do we make our hearts strong, clear, and resilient enough to engage meaningfully, sustainably in some of the most challenging crises our species has ever faced, mm-hmm. in terms of climate, war, refugee?
Yeah. There's so many now, we have to stop listing them because it becomes the whole show, right?
Right, yeah.
I've stopped doing that just because it becomes overwhelming at times to think about all that we are challenged with. It's just different, I think, than what people were challenged with before, but it is also existential. So it takes on greater importance. This may seem simplistic, and you've answered part of it already, but I'm just thinking for listeners and viewers who haven't done any of these modalities, or maybe mm-hmm. are not even familiar with the terms like a personal or a social transformation.
Sure.
Can you just give a little bit of a everyman's description for
absolutely.
That?
Absolutely.
Every person's.
Yeah. Well,
the hardest part, right? Going to the very
beginning. Let's start with the outer, and then we'll do the inner. So, you know, social transformation means improving the systems that and institutions that govern our society for the better. And alongside that process, and it's a kind of, I think it's sort of a braided thing, transforming the underlying paradigms and views that guide those systems. So for example, you know, one of the movements that's held up in history, particularly here in the United States, is the civil rights movement is an example of social transformation, right? And even after, say, the Voting Rights Act or the Civil Rights Act was passed, huge portions of the population were not for it. So mm-hmm. the legislation created the conditions for some to begin to change their ideas and their views. Mm-hmm. So looking at things like how do we provide clean water and healthcare and food and housing and energy, basic human rights to, you know, to mm-hmm. people everywhere. These are how do we reduce hunger and poverty and war? These are questions of social transformation. Mm-hmm. Personal transformation, individual transformation, there are many levels to it. And I think it depends on one's interest, one's goals, and also the particular practice or modality that you're using, what that means. So one of the most common examples of personal transformation today would be psychotherapy. Being in therapy is a form of personal transformation and healing. You're trying to understand your own psychological and emotional patterns, the places where you feel stuck or hurt. And through understanding and feeling and working through those challenges, we change inside. Part of who we are changes, part of how we live changes, part of how we interact changes. Something like nonviolent communication, on the surface, is about communicating more effectively. So there's a sort of internal transformation that happens there in terms of skill building and also our perspectives and underlying intentions or motives in conversations, so that we can have healthier relationships, more effective conversations. Spiritual practice.
Just give one more example here,
because these different examples of personal transformation. Spiritual practice, which is the domain of like religion, philosophy, spirituality, is aimed at. Different practices have different aims again, but in general, we could say it's aimed at a kind of deeper, more fundamental transformation of the very basis of how we live and understand who we are and what it is to be alive. So it's a little bit like, just to use a sort of technological metaphor, it's a little bit like uncoding and reprogramming the OS of a human life, the underlying operating system. So that we are living in a way that creates less suffering for ourselves and others.
Thank you for that. It's a lot. Right?
It is. I'd love to elaborate on the spiritual practice piece and make it a little bit more accessible for folks, if that's okay.
I'd love you to. Yeah.
So the subtitle of the book is Contemplative Practices to Meet a World in Crisis. So what is contemplative practice? I think this is an important question for all of us, particularly those who maybe haven't been exposed to it, because it can sound kind of esoteric and what is that? And I don't want to, you know, be involved in that sort of thing. So contemplative practice means having a relationship with your inner life. It's the recognition that we all have an inner world. We have, there's a part of what it is to be human that is not only about our physical needs for food, shelter. It goes beyond our relational needs for connection, understanding, interaction, community, belonging, that there's something about being human that is precious and immaterial that we can feel and sense in our heart and our mind. And so contemplative practice is anything that connects us with our values, with a sense of purpose or meaning, with something larger than ourselves, or that gives us perspective on things and on our life. And meditation is one form of contemplative practice. So the analogy that I like to use is meditation is to contemplative practice as running is to exercise. So we all need to exercise. The human body was designed to move. If you don't move, your systems slowly start to fail. But not everyone likes to or wants to run. Doesn't mean you stop exercising. It just means you find another way to move.
That's a great analogy.
So meditation is one form of taking care of your heart and mind. But if you don't want to or don't like to meditate, that's fine. We need to find some other method for this kind of mental and emotional hygiene to take care of ourselves every day. And so contemplative practice really opens that whole field up. And anything can be a contemplative practice. So you could think of things like being in nature, art, music, storytelling. But folding the laundry can be a contemplative practice.
No, it's
doing
true.
The dishes. It's not about what you're doing. It's about how you're doing it. And the qualities of attention and presence and intention that you're bringing to it. And this is really the foundation of the training I lay out in the book. It's this understanding that when we begin to have a sense of how our minds actually work, every day we can use the things that we're doing and the time that we have to build a well of inner resources, so that even when we're not, say, formally working on collective transformation or trying to heal our hearts, or we can still be building inner strengths. Our activities and our time can be purposeful, meaningful, nourishing. We can be strengthening qualities like patience, wholeheartedness, resolve, energy, generosity, kindness, compassion, just by doing the ordinary things of our life and day. But it takes practice and understanding for how to actually do that. And that's what the book is trying to lay out for folks.
Which is interesting, because it doesn't seem that it would take practice, but it does. Because as you said that, and some of these qualities that we talk about, that you talk about in the book, that I read about, you know, it kind of reminds me of like everything, what was the name of that book? Everything I Needed to Know. I learned in kindergarten,
right.
And because these are human qualities that we are exposed to, but we don't develop them ever, or we drop them along the way. And when you're talking about doing things like folding the clothes or doing the dishes, that can be a spiritual, that can be a meaningful experience, or any other activity that how do we remember, you know, that, right. And this is, I guess, the practice, right? How do you remember when somebody interrupts you or breaks in, you know, harms you or even, you know, does something mild? How do we remember to go back to those qualities that you talk about in the book?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that's why it's practice. You make a few really good points there. And the first one that I want to elaborate on is this sense of everything I needed to know I learned in kindergarten. One of the great blessings of having a child has been witnessing what I have believed, and I would even say known to be true through my spiritual practice in a different way, which is that our nature is loving, is kind, is generous, that we have to be taught to hate, and that you know, these qualities like generosity and joy, are determination, that these are innate to us as human beings, and even empathy.
Definitely.
And I see this on a daily basis in my son, you know, playing on the couch, and he's eating a little slice of apple, and he takes a nibble or two, and then he gives it to me.
Yeah.
He wants to feed me. You know, this is when he was 8 months old.
Oh, really? Oh my gosh.
It's just
so
innate.
He feels the innateness of it. Yes.
Yeah. You know, or
so
just
beautiful.
The seeing as a newborn comes out, as their senses develop, and their eyes begin to, you know, be able to have depth perception, and they recognize there's another being there, and they can feel it in their bodies beforehand. But just how powerful that sense of empathy and connection is, and how important it is for him to just have one of us nearby when he's playing, and to just give him our full attention. So all of these qualities in the book that I talk about, these are innate capacities that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And as you point to, if we don't attend to them, if they're not encouraged and reinforced and developed through early childhood, but into and beyond into adulthood, they atrophy, they wither.
Yeah.
So that's the first point, is that they're there and they need to be developed. Even something as, let's say, profound as balance, equanimity is the term that I use. It comes from Buddhism. You know, a toddler has no equanimity, but they have a lot more actually than a newborn. Than it, you know, that the sense of non-reactivity develops as we grow, as we become sensitized to the world. So I wanted to comment on that. You asked another question about how do we remember, but I want to leave some space for you to respond or follow up before going to that.
My son may not appreciate that I'm sharing this on the podcast, but it just seems so poignant related to what you were talking about with your son sharing the apple. When he was about three, he was falling, a little less maybe, he was maybe three, he was falling asleep, and I was putting him to bed and probably read him a story and was leaving the room. And I remember, because it has affected me to this day, he said, Mom, oh God, almost like chokes me up. He goes, I'm starting to forget what God looks like.
Oh.
And that makes me so curious to all the things that you just said, that we come into the world still so attached with all those, all that love and all those capabilities still in us. And that maybe it's our job to carry on that work. And clearly it is. Mm. That's the job that you have taken up here. Yeah. It's like we were handed over the job as parents or as caregivers to keep that spirituality, that love, that purity going. And we see it,
to protect it, and to nourish and encourage it. Mm. Right? We have to see it first. We have to recognize it. And you can't recognize something in someone else that you don't already know in yourself to some degree.
Which would say that as generation after generation fails to do that, we become more and more removed from the ability to do it. And that's why your training is really so important. And it does seem like it's something that, yes, we should have learned or were exposed to in kindergarten when we learned to share and all those things. But it's weird that it does take work. So I guess we'll have to put a little more attention on it.
I mean, this is part of what it is to be human, is that we have these different tendencies and forces in us, right? You know, it's toddler is not all joy and happiness and play. There's fear, there's anger, there's selfishness, right? And some of those have a kind of adaptive functions. Different forms of religion will talk about that we have these different natures. We have, it's a little bit ethnocentric, or anthropocentric, but we have a more kind of animal-like nature. Mm. Of course, animals have all kinds of qualities and wisdom that we can learn from, but we have a kind of, you know, tribal, aggressive, violent nature in the heart. We've studied this in humans, this sort of in-group bias and so forth. And then we also have, a nature that is more loving, depending on one's perspective. You could call it a divine nature. You could call it an empathic nature, but there are these different forces and tendencies in the heart and the mind. And of course, what we have in our world are social systems built upon some of those more harmful forces, like fear and greed and separation. Mm-hmm. And when you have systems and institutions that are founded upon worldviews and underlying perspectives rooted in fear, separation, scarcity, we see the results. We get vast income inequality. We get war, poverty, homelessness. Mm. So this intricate relationship between personal and social transformation is that as we work to try to transform the systems and institutions and structures of our society, we also need to be recognizing, unearthing, and transforming the underlying tendencies and structures in our own hearts and minds that fuel those systems. So patriarchy, sexism, racism, fear of the other, greed. These are the forces that drive political, economic systems, monetary systems, criminal justice systems that compound human suffering. Mm. And so to create systems rooted in generosity and compassion, we need to feel and understand and be rooted in those qualities deeply in ourselves, so that we can envision and work for a different kind of world.
So we're creating these systems. We can't really always see what we've created. We can't all, it's very rare that people stop and look back, and because so much of it is invisible to us, you know, so many, like, people talk about institutional racism or, you know, systemic racism from so many generations ago that we don't even think about it anymore. And it's built into all of our, it's built into all of our systems, our government and our so many parts of our life.
We don't think about them if we benefit from them, but if we don't benefit from them, Correct. We think about them every day.
Well, that's right.
Because
right.
they're oppressing us.
Right. No, that is, that's a very important point to make. But just that we have to examine them before we can change them, I guess is the point.
Yeah. And, you know, it's the case, I think, that they're not even things that any of us have created at this point, but they are what we live in.
Their legacies.
You know, they have a life of their own, right? And we are all existing within them. And it's beyond just the, you know, the functions that they perform for us. There's a whole sort of mindset of modernity that we live within that's based upon certain views and assumptions of what it is to be human and how we relate to the earth and how we understand ourselves and life and even what frame what a problem is or how to go about engaging with it. So it's a very, it's very kind of deep work to live into a new way of being and bring that into our world.
Especially, I was going to say, when we have such different approaches to it. And I wanted to, I want, at the beginning of your book, in the introduction, you had so many important things to say. And unfortunately, the first thing I'm going to say is not your direct quote, but it's a quote that you included, which I think speaks to what we were just on, which is, this was from Grace Lee Boggs, who is the great Chinese-American activist for civil rights and the environment and so many other causes. But she wrote, we need a vision that recognizes that we are at one of the great turning points in human history, when the survival of our planet and the restoration of our humanity require a great sea change in our ecological, economic, political, and spiritual values. I think she names them quite well in that.
Yeah.
The reason I brought it up is because I think she's naming there, and you are also seconding it by putting this in there, that I think she speaks to one of the greatest challenges that we face, which is a vision, that we are lacking a vision, and we're certainly lacking the same vision. That's to me where the rubber meets the road, that even if we do individually and even collectively try to improve on these important qualities of humanity, that we don't see the world the same and we can't seem to get on the same page. And I don't know how we bring our visions together. We see, increasingly, I don't know, in my lifetime, they have become more disparate rather than less.
Well, we may never be able to. And I think the more we try, the more we're not using energy to figure out what matters and what we need, which is the simple recognition that our lives are intertwined and we're either going to live together or we're going to die together. So, you know, the vision may never align. But the reality is something that hopefully we can recognize, which is that we live on a planet that has limited resources, where everything we do affects each other. And so how do we live together and share resources? That's the most kind of fundamental question, I think, for our times. And so can our communities, our neighborhoods, our socials and political systems begin to attend to meeting human needs, you know? So, you know, that's the point. That's what government and systems and structures are supposed to be doing, is meeting human needs. Right. And they're only meeting the human needs of certain people, certain groups of people. And they're not meeting the needs of others, human and non-human, right? Let's broaden it beyond the human world to recognize that we live here with a lot of other forms of life that we're intimately connected to, and that we need for not just our physical survival, but also our emotional and spiritual well-being. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to live in a world that doesn't have songbirds. I don't want to live in a world without whales. You know, we need the sort of the wonder and the depth and the mystery of these other creatures. Mm. So I agree with you that we do need vision. The way that I talk about that in the book is aspiration, which is the second chapter, because we need some sense of where we're going. Otherwise, we don't bring forth the energy for change.
Right.
So the book starts, to come back to your question before, of like, how do we remember? The first chapter in the book is about attention, which is one of our most valuable resources, and one that many of us overlook and give away for free.
We squander it.
Well, we squander it, but we also allow it to be bought and sold through the media and technology.
Oh.
So everything in the media and technology is trying to capture and retain our attention and turn it into profit and influence our behavior. Buy this, go here, don't pay attention to this, pay attention to this instead, vote this way or don't vote. So we need to work to reclaim our attention, both internally and externally. Externally, to have more agency in relation to the media and technology, and then internally, as you were pointing out, in terms of our own habits of just squandering our time and our attention and wasting it on things that are not meaningful or useful in the best sense for us. So the first chapter looks at the resource we have of attention and how to start to begin to reclaim it and have some agency over where we place our attention from day to day. That's the foundation of remembering and being able to practice all of these beautiful qualities and live a more meaningful life and contribute. The next chapter is about, okay, why am I doing this? We need some sense of remembering what's possible. And really committing to it. And that's going to occur differently to each of us. And it's going to occur differently to us, perhaps from week to week, and certainly from year to year in our life. But it's our North Star. And what are we taking as our North Star? You know, so for me, one of my North Stars right now is I want to be the best husband and father I can be. And every day I fail. Every day I'm humbled. And that doesn't mean that it's not still my North Star. It brings inspiration and renewal and energy to recognize I have the potential to move in that direction.
Yeah.
I have the potential to be present and loving and patient and forgiving with my wife and my child. I have the potential to pause and breathe when I feel frustrated or angry or anxious or stressed. And so having that North Star, articulating and remembering that aspiration and recommitting to it every day is part of what brings the energy and helps our whole way of understanding our life and the things that we do in any given day to begin to have a sense of purpose and meaning and start to fall into alignment with what's actually important for us.
You know, thank you for that. And I'd like you to speak about how the book is laid out and really what it's for a little bit more specifically before maybe we talk about some of the other qualities, because I will just start by saying that I don't know where I read this exactly, but that it was designed to be read over the course of a year.
That's right.
26
That's in the introduction.
Qualities.
That's right.
And I'll have you talk about what's in each chapter, because it's a format that is repeated in each chapter.
Right.
And so I'll have you talk about that a little bit. I have to say, when I read that, I was so happy and grateful, because usually, especially for the podcast, I read books pretty quickly, or I skim them sometimes because I can't get through several weeks in a row. And I read that and I thought, this is why there's many books out there and they fail to achieve perhaps what they set out for, is that people read right through them and pick up another one or read right through. it's designed to take a year to read and to absorb and to practice. I absolutely am grateful to you for that. And I think it's going to change how I read everything in the future. There's no reason to have to rush through something if you really haven't gotten it and to be able to actually practice it. So let's talk a little bit about how
that's you just said it beautifully. You said it beautifully yourself. And, you know, the 26 chapters is if you do 2 weeks per chapter, that there's your 52 weeks. There's there's a whole year. So that's how I came up with 26. And, you know, when we're thinking about real transformation, lasting transformation, not just, oh, that was a nice experience, and now I fall back into my old habits, it takes time, right? You know, however old we are, well, we've got that many decades of conditioning, of habits, of momentum. Those don't just go away or change overnight because you read a good book or even went on a meditation retreat or, you know, did something powerful.
Yeah.
It takes time. It takes time and patience and diligence. So that's why it's laid out this way to do a whole year. And then I'll say a couple more things about the structure. So one is there is a certain logic to the unfolding of the chapters and the different parts of the book. And some people may choose to read the book chronologically from beginning to end. However, I also like to think about the table of contents as a little bit like a menu or a choose your own adventure. And, you know, the idea is you sit down, you know, I encourage people to read at least the first few chapters through because it frames what we're doing and it frames the book. You get a sense of what's happening. But then it's like, well, what do I need right now? You look at the table of contents, and I'm going to look at it right now. And, you know, it's like, oh, let's see, wisdom, curiosity, courage, integrity. Oh, rest. Oh, God, I need some rest. I'm exhausted, you know, or, play. Ah, gosh, I could really use some more play in my life. Let's jump to the chapter on play, even though it's right at the end. You know, like, so it's designed to really be a companion in our lives and to meet us where we are. And that it takes a certain wisdom, it takes a certain self-understanding to listen inside and say, what do I need right now? What's the medicine that's going to help me come back to balance? And so that's a process that I encourage people to develop through the course of the book, is this kind of sensing what's needed and learning how to orient to these different capacities or qualities that we have and use them as a way of finding the kind of inner balance and poise and strength to be with the difficulties in our own hearts, relationships, and worlds. So each chapter has its own structure, which you you mentioned, and what that is the chapters are relatively short. They're designed. The idea here is that you could read them, you know, in the course of 2 or 3 days without taking a ton of time out of your life. But my aim was to also try to make them deep enough that they're thought provoking. So the body of the chapter looks at the particular quality and unpacks it. What does this actually mean? What's its relevance in our lives? What's its relevance in our world? How has this quality played a role in personal and social transformation in my own life, in social movements, in history? So it's a way of understanding the importance of this, of what is this quality and what is its importance? Why should I care about this, in other words?
And why how do I spend time? Why should I spend time curating it or broadening it in my life?
Exactly. And then the end of each chapter has a few sections. So the first section is a reflection, which is something to think about. It's something to ponder. It's something to just chew on as you go through your day or your week, or you could journal about it. Then the next section is a meditation. So for those who would like, it's actually, okay, now sit down, try to get quiet for 5 minutes or longer, and explore this. Try doing this. And this is a way to begin to go back to that technological metaphor, to start to explore, like, what are the programs I've got running in my own heart and mind, and which ones do I want to quit, and which ones do I want to try to actually strengthen a little bit?
Yeah.
And then there's an action. So that here's something you can do in your life. Here's a way to put this quality into practice. And there's a few ideas or suggestions there. And then the last part of every chapter are common difficulties. So here are some obstacles you might encounter and some ways to work with those.
I really appreciated that last part because, you know, we get into this type of mindset that we have to do everything just right. And if I, you know, whatever it is, and to say, oh, that's right. I'm human. I'm going to have difficulties with this. I've been doing it a different way for 5 decades for however long. Maybe I'm going to have some difficulties. And oh, even the author of the book sees that I'm, you know, with all the work he's done, he also, you know, can see that there are difficulties. If it weren't difficult, we'd all be showing those qualities relentlessly. Right. And so obviously there are difficulties in developing them. Really, really interesting. I'm curious, when you wrote this book, and I've seen some reference to what your thinking was, this was during the COVID pandemic shutdown when you, because I'm curious what got in your, you know, what was your thinking? I mean, my podcast was an outcome of that time as well. It made us all stop and think quite a bit about life a little bit differently and what we need. So
it started in the pandemic. And as just really, I was like seeing what was happening around, you know, our communities and in the world, and I just wanted to contribute. And one way that I could do that was to just start writing about resilience and the qualities that can help us in difficult times.
Yeah.
So that's how the book started, was writing about these qualities that can help us. And then when my wife got pregnant, it took on a different meaning. Mm-hmm. And this deep question came in of, you know, what really is the relevance of meditation and contemplative practice in the midst of climate change and vast income inequality and spreading war and refugee crises? And so it took on this very deep, intimate, personal reflection on how does what I do with my life and my work and my teaching relate to the need for transformation in our world so that our children have a viable planet to live on. And so those were the two main sort of questions and forces behind the book.
Good reasons. I mean, they compelled you to write all the way through this. And I'm sure, do you feel like that writing the book and thinking about it in a way that maybe you hadn't, I doubt that you had that much thought about those. Yeah, I bet.
I learned a ton by writing the book. In fact, you know, I'm a meditation teacher and a communication trainer. My activism is not out in the streets with signs demonstrating, but I also consider myself an activist. I'm part of a network here in the Bay Area that is committed to engaging and supporting nonviolent direct action. But I do my activist work in other ways. In small ways locally, and by being a part of this community and supporting those efforts in ways that I can with my skills and my training and my presence. But all that's to say, I didn't have the background or the time to understand and do the research around, well, you know, where is play relevant in social movements for change?
Right.
You know, I know it is, but where and how? Exactly. So I hired a friend and colleague of mine, Chris Moore Backman, who's a Gandhian nonviolent scholar, to do some consulting with me on the project. And he's there in the acknowledgments. And, you know, we talked about every chapter and the qualities. We went back and forth, and he gave me things
really
to
nice.
Read. And so many of the examples that are woven throughout the book are, you know, from that collaboration and from, you know, I learned
That's
a
great.
Ton
yeah.
about
yeah.
social movements. Yeah. And then also, you know, there were colleagues that read different chapters and gave me feedback and pushed me, you know, really pushed me to say, you know, well, I think this is missing here, or you're not addressing the dynamics of power and privilege enough, or this chapter seems to suggest that take a very individualistic approach to addressing climate change, and I don't think that's enough. You know, what if you look at it in this way? So I learned a lot through not only the process of writing, but also the dialogues that it sparked with colleagues and editor and consultant friend of mine. Yeah.
It's really helpful to have more eyes on it. Just like you said, you need a community for everything, and writing a book is really not that different. It's a lonely process, but it's nice to have some help along the way. You know, I had a question about, I notice that when I'm, I don't know if you've ever seen, maybe not seen any of my other podcasts, but I'm usually, I have a strong ADD. And when I talk to people, I often interrupt them and I often get too carried away. I kind of get flying and I don't do that with you. And, and I knew that I wouldn't because, first of all, I have this sort of thing where I just meld into other people. So that's sort of a problem that I have. I don't really have these firm boundaries that I try to work on. But, if you have an accent, I'll have an accent too in 5 seconds. So, but it does lead to the idea that a person who brings presence, calmness, yourself actually to the room, to a conversation, it affects other people. And I know this is before your time, but I'm sure you've heard that when Maharishi Yogi said, I think it was in the 70s, he said, if 1% of the world were to practice transcendental meditation, the world would be, a much more peaceful place. And I have to believe now that more than 1% of the world probably does practice meditation. I would hope. It seems like it. Like everybody's talking. Maybe not. Whether that's true or not, they have done studies that have shown that there's been an impact on communities. But I will just say it's very palpable to me, your presence, and that you have a calming presence. If we were all, if a certain percentage of us were to practice these skills more often, be around people like you that carry that and hold that light, does that have in your mind, have you seen that have an impact on those around you?
Yes and no. I think we need to be careful here. There's a truth that you're speaking, and then there's also what I would consider a myth or a popular notion that's actually dangerous, which I talk about in the introduction. So I think that the truth that you're speaking is that when we are clear, present, grounded, and non-reactive, we are better positioned to affect change and help others. Period. One of my favorite stories or quotes about this comes from the Vietnamese Buddhist Zen master, the late Thich Nhat Hanh, who used the analogy of the refugees from Vietnam at that time crossing the Gulf of Siam in boats and how dangerous it was. You know, today there's other refugees making that journey, a similar journey from North Africa to Europe. And he said, many of the boats capsize and people die. And he said, if there's one person in the boat who can stay calm, who knows what to do, they can save many lives. Mm-hmm. And he said, our world is like a small boat, and we need people who can stay calm and clear instead of adding fuel to the fire through reactivity. So that I absolutely believe that to be true, and that's the kind of thing you're maybe naming your experience. It's like, it's nice to talk to you. I don't feel like I'm interrupting as much. I feel more
I'm relaxed.
Settled. Yeah.
And I can hear you better. I can hear you.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is, we have science that demonstrates this through the process of co-regulation in our nervous systems. We know that when one person's nervous system is relaxed, it can help the other person deactivate.
Definitely.
And so that's one. Now, the thing that Maharishi said, personally, I believe is a little bit of a dangerous misconception, actually. I would disagree with him. I'm all for, 10% of the human population meditating.
Sure.
But I talk about this in the introduction. What my meditation teacher said when I first started training is, the individual makes the family. The family makes the communities. Right. Communities make the nation, and nations make the world. So if we take care of ourselves and meditate and become more loving, kind people, our families will become more loving and kind, our communities will become more loving and kind, and the world will become a more loving and kind place. That's the logic.
Right.
Right?
Right.
I think that logic is flawed in two major ways. Okay. Number one, it's going to take way too long and we don't have enough time. The time scale for the climate crisis and the changes that we need to make is very short relative to the amount of time it takes for enough individuals to become spiritually awakened in some way, you know, or just even a little bit kinder and more generous to actually have sort of large scale collective change. So yeah. That's one. Right. Let me just finish the arc and then you can argue or
no,
rebut.
I don't have an argument.
I welcome being challenged.
Yeah. Well,
the second point is that logic that says if enough of us change our hearts and minds, the world will change and be better, mm-hmm. is that it does not take into account the pervasive presence of structural and systemic issues which have their own life and need to be engaged with and addressed on their own level. And this is what we were talking about before, is that the forces of institutions exist on a different level than individual action.
Right.
And there is such a thing, you know, this has again been demonstrated since in sociology, is such a thing as network effects. And so we need to also engage on the structural and collective level. We need to make policy changes. We need to reform education, healthcare, justice system. And these are not just individual changes. But again, you can see how when we start thinking about making policy change or reforming a particular institution or system, I want the people on that committee to be really clear, grounded, loving, balanced, compassionate, generous people.
Right.
I want them to have some internal transformation work done. So the two are connected.
Right.
And we need to work on both levels.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess I don't see that as a myth, only because it seems more that you're talking about a time frame and the urgency of specific problems. I mean, this is not how we're going to get climate change fixed, that's for sure.
Yeah.
We do not have the luxury of that arc that may or may not ever happen because it's optional.
It might be an overstatement. I appreciate that. It might be an overstatement to say it's a myth. It's more just that it's not going to get us to where we need to be in the time that we need it.
No. Right. So still necessary, still helpful, still does change families, communities. I mean, haven't you seen that in your own experience? And we're right at an hour, so I'm gonna pull it to an end here. But I would think that have you not seen the influence of your own presence on other people, or are you too close to it to
sometimes.
See?
Sometimes,
sometimes. Well, like you said, we're still human.
We like to say in the meditation circles that I teach in that. Family is graduate school. It's postdoc.
Family.
So family is the hardest because they're the ones, you know, we talk about in psychology, they talk about, you know, someone's pushing your buttons.
Yeah.
Well, your family is the one, they're the ones who installed your buttons.
Exactly.
So, they're the ones who are actually in many cases, particularly our family of origin, but depending on how long we've had our own family, that family too, they're also, it's hardest to see each other clearly because we're seeing each other through the filters of past experience and to really see and receive someone's presence, one has to be open to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this is also why the change yourself, change the world logic, it only works in certain situations because you come up against individuals who are so closed off, their hearts are so armored, and they are so rooted in their way of doing things or seeing things that, you know, even the Buddha wouldn't be able to change their mind. And if you read the early Pali Canon, his family, his clan went to war, and he couldn't stop it. So, you know, it's not just about how loving and present or patient we are and that having this ripple effect on others.
Right.
The others have to be open to some degree to receive it. They have to be able to recognize it and feel it. And it's possible that they're too traumatized, their hearts have become too hardened, they're too defended to actually take in
Right. And that may take some time to get past through generations sometimes. So it is, we have to come at things from many angles, I think would be the point. Let's, can you tell us a little, I know you've got some online trainings, you have some workshops and
absolutely
retreats that sound very, very,
I'm
excited to go on your website. So where can people learn like a little bit more about you and how to engage with you and learn from you?
Sure. Well, my website is the best place to stay in touch and learn more about what I'm doing. I teach online regularly now, particularly raising a family. I try to do a lot of work from home and teach online. I have a lot of events that are free or by donation.
Yeah.
And then I do teach meditation retreats, both online and in person. And I teach online courses in nonviolent communication and mindfulness, and all of that information is on my website. And if folks have appreciated our conversation and want to stay in touch or learn more, I would love that. The best way to do that is through my email list. I send out roughly one email a month when I can make the time. And I always try to include something meaningful and uplifting. And then I am also on social media, at Orin J. Sofer. You can find me there. And my website is my full name, orinjsofer.com.
And I will, of course, I'll put that up on the screen and also have it on the show notes so that if people didn't catch all of that, they'll be able to find you. And the book is available pretty much anywhere.
Yeah, books available
everywhere. Books are sold.
Yes, and if you would like to purchase a copy or check it out, if you go to my website, there is you can download some free guided meditations after you purchase the book on my website. I'm happy to offer those to you.
Yeah, highly recommend all of it. The book is wonderful. I've skimmed it. I've read the beginnings and I've read parts of it, and I'm completely in on spending a year on this. I can't imagine a better way to spend the next year. And not that you have to put it away after that year, but anyway. All right. Orin J. Sofer, not the opposite. Thank you so much for spending this time with us, for writing the book, for being out there in the world and changing it, helping us all change it. Appreciate it so much.
Thanks for your work and thanks for having me on the show, Deborah.
Okay. Take care.